Why not brine in a more flavorful solution? Why not, indeed? I decided to find out. Here's what I tried. Sample number one, plain, untreated. Sample number two, brined overnight in a 6% salt solution. Sample number three, heavily salted overnight. Sample number four, brined overnight in chicken broth with a 6% salt content. Sample number five, brined overnight in cider with a 6% salt content. Sample number six, soaked overnight in plain water. Samples number one and number six were included as a control to ensure that the brine and salt solutions were behaving as expected. As expected, the brined chicken samples held on to significantly more moisture than either the untreated breasts or the water-soaked breasts. Indeed, in this test, the water-soaked breasts actually ended up drier on average than the plain breasts. The water-soaked chicken breast was as dry as the Gobi Desert on an admittedly very moist for a desert day. The brined chicken breast was as plump and juicy as a benevolent ant in a Disney film. Tasting it, there's a definite case of wet sponge syndrome. Water comes out of it as you chew, giving you the illusion of juiciness, but the texture is a little too loose and the flavor a little bland. Moving on to the salted breast, we find that it's still significantly moister than the non-salted breast, though it was a couple of percentage points drier than the brined breast. Tasting it, it's undoubtedly more juicy and well-seasoned, with a stronger chicken flavor. Texture-wise, it's significantly different from both plain and brined turkey, with a smooth, dense but tender texture of lightly cured meat. Visually, there will be clear signs of this curing with its decidedly pink hue. With a small chicken breast, the moist pink cured section extends nearly to the center of the breast. On a turkey, you'd only see it around the outer edges, which, serendipitously, happen to be the parts most prone to overcooking and drying out. While the brined breast was slightly juicier, flavorful, and texture-wise, I'd take the salted chicken over the brined any day. What about flavored brines? First off, don't try to brine your turkey or chicken in cider, or any other acidic marinade for that matter. Just don't. The acid in the cider will begin the denaturization process of the meat, effectively cooking it without heat. The results? Ultra-dry meat with a wrinkled, completely desiccated exterior. More interesting were the results of the broth-brined chicken. It seems like the ultimate solution, right? If brining forces bland water into your meat, why not replace that water with flavorful broth? Unfortunately, physics is a fickle mistress who refuses to be reined in. In tasting the broth-brined chicken next to the plain-brined chicken, there was barely a noticeable difference in flavor. The broth-brined chicken still had the same hallmarks of a regular brined bird. Juicy, wet texture, bland flavor. What the heck's going on? There are two principles at work here. The first is that while to the naked eye, broth is a pure liquid, in reality, a broth consists of water with a vast array of dissolved solids in it that contribute flavor. Most of these flavorful molecules are organic compounds that are relatively large in size, on a molecular scale that is, while salt molecules are quite small. So, while salt can easily pass across the semi-permeable membranes that make up the cells in animal tissue, larger molecules cannot. Additionally, there's an effect called salting out, which occurs in water-based solutions containing both proteins and salt. Water molecules are attracted to salt ions and will selectively interact with them. The poor proteins, meanwhile, are left with only each other and end up forming large aggregate groups that make it even harder for them to get into the meat. When the salt breaks down muscle fibers sufficiently to allow the uptake of water, plenty of water and salt get into the meat, but very little protein does. The result? Unless you are using an extra-concentrated homemade stock, the amount of flavorful compounds that make it inside your chicken or turkey will be very, very limited. Given the amount of stock you'd need to make this concentrated broth, it doesn't seem like a wise move. What does all this mean? Well, let me end the way I started. I don't brine my birds, because I like my birds to taste like birds, not like watered-down birds. Salting the meat is nearly as effective at preventing moisture loss, and the flavor gains are noticeable. Want to know the truth? Even advanced salting is not a necessary first step. I see it more as a safeguard against overcooking. It provides a little buffer in case you accidentally let that bird sit in the oven for an extra 15 minutes. As long as you are very careful about monitoring your bird, there's no reason to salt it in advance. That said, it doesn't hurt to take precautions and let deliciousness, merriment, and family bonding ensue. You may not all be able to agree on whether the cranberries belong in the stuffing or on the side, but at least you can all agree that this is one darn tasty bird. How to dry brine a bird. Salting poultry under its skin and letting it stand for a period of 24 to 48 hours in the refrigerator has much the same effect as brining. At first, the salt draws liquid out of the meat, and this time it really is through osmosis. But then it dissolves in this extracted liquid, forming a concentrated bird juice brine right on the surface of the bird that then goes to work at dissolving muscle fibers the same way as a regular brine. Eventually, as the muscle fibers get more and more relaxed, the liquid is reabsorbed. Over the course of a night or two, the salty solution can work its way several millimeters into the bird's flesh, helping it retain moisture and seasoning it more deeply. In some regards, it's more of a pain than regular brining. You have to loosen the skin from the meat, but it doesn't require the use of a massive cooler or ice-filled tub, and it doesn't dilute flavor in the way a regular brine does. To dry brine a bird, first carefully loosen the skin by running your hand or the handle of a wooden spoon between the skin and the breast meat, starting at the base of the breast. Then rub about 1 teaspoon of diamond crystal kosher salt per pound of meat all over its body, under its skin. Place the bird on a rack set over a large plate or rimmed baking sheet and refrigerate uncovered overnight, or for up to 48 hours if using a turkey. The next day, cook as directed, skipping or going light on the seasoning step. There's the rub. When treating the skin of your turkey or chicken, there are a few options. Going naked is the easiest and will give you the crispest skin, particularly if you let the bird air dry on a rack set in a rimmed baking sheet, uncovered, overnight in the fridge. Just don't let it dry for more than a day, or it'll turn papery and tough. Dry rubs made from salt mixed with spices or dried herbs can add flavor to the skin. For best results, apply them the day before and let the bird air dry overnight in the fridge. Oil rubbed onto the skin will get you a more even golden brown color, as it helps distribute heat from the hot oven air more evenly. It'll also help prevent the skin from drying out and turning leathery, though it will slightly decrease crispness. Butter, or an herb butter, will add lots of flavor to the skin. Don't expect it to soak into the meat much, even if you spread it underneath the skin, but it'll also greatly reduce its crispness. Butter is about 18% water, which will cool down the skin as it evaporates. And the milk proteins present in butter will brown on their own, so poultry skin rubbed with butter will have a spottier appearance than skin rubbed with oil. Some people prefer this appearance. I do on occasion. How to roast a bird. Who doesn't love roast chicken? Crackly, crisp, salty skin. Moist, tender meat. Deep aromas filling the house. Little bits of fat and meat to tear off with your fingers or teeth as you linger over the last sips of your whiskey. Whiskey goes with chicken, right? It's about as classy and classic as food can get, and my go-to meal for company or the rare quiet night in with the wife and dog. But to be perfectly frank, most of the time, I don't like roast chicken, because most of the time, well, chicken just isn't roasted very well. The problem is one I'm sure every one of you has experienced: dry breast meat, and it doesn't just apply to chicken. We've all also experienced dry turkey. I'm not talking about the kind that frays around the edges as soon as a carving knife comes close to it, or that instantly turns to sawdust when it hits your tongue. I'm talking the kind that is just good enough that you can still smile and say nice things during dinner, but just bad enough that you wonder why the pilgrims couldn't have eaten prime rib during that first fall. The problem, as we all know, is with overcooking. So first, let's take a quick look at what happens to chicken breast meat as it cooks. Under 120 degrees Fahrenheit, the meat is still considered raw. Muscle cells are bundled up and aligned in long, straight, cable-like fibrils wrapped in sheaths of elastic connective tissues, which are what gives meat its grain. At 120 degrees Fahrenheit, the protein myosin begins to coagulate, forcing some liquid out of the muscle cells, which then collects within the protein sheaths. At 140 degrees Fahrenheit, the remaining proteins within the muscle cells coagulate, forcing all of the liquid out of the cells and into the protein sheaths. The coagulated proteins turn the meat firm and opaque. I like my chicken and turkey breasts cooked to 140 degrees Fahrenheit. At 150 degrees Fahrenheit, the proteins in the sheaths themselves, mainly collagen, rapidly coagulate and contract. All the water that was forced out of the cells and collected within the sheaths is now squeezed out of the meat completely. Despite government warnings to be sure to cook chicken to 165 degrees Fahrenheit, in reality, above 150 degrees Fahrenheit or so, muscle fibers have become almost completely squeezed dry. Congratulations, your dinner is now officially cardboard. On the other hand, leg meat must be cooked to at least 170 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay, that's a bit of an overstatement. It'll still be perfectly edible at around 160 degrees Fahrenheit. Any lower than that, and the abundant connective tissue will remain tough. But the juices will still be pink or red, and the meats will not have yet reached optimal tenderness. Unlike breast meat, leg meat contains plenty of collagen. Given a high enough temperature, say 160 degrees Fahrenheit and above, and a long enough time, say the 10 minutes it takes the legs to get from 160 degrees to 170 degrees Fahrenheit, the collagen will begin to convert into rich gelatin, keeping the meat moist and juicy even after the muscle fibers have shed most of their liquid. So, the question is, how do you cook legs to 170 degrees Fahrenheit without taking the breasts beyond 145 degrees Fahrenheit? I use three different methods, depending on the situation and the bird at hand. Here they are, starting with the most effective and most laborious. Poultry cooking method 1, my favorite, spatchcocking. I'm gonna come right out and say it. This is the best way to cook a bird, hands down. It's now the only method I ever use. I understand that some folks like to see a whole bird arrive at the table looking like a whole bird. But if I had my way, the gospel of spatchcocked birds would spread around the world. To butterfly, a less fancy term for spatchcock, a bird, all you've got to do is use a pair of sharp poultry shears to cut out the spine, then flatten it with its skin side up by pressing down firmly on the breastbone. Voila! That's it. It's a really simple operation that you'll get the hang of in no time, and it even works for turkeys. Here's how cooking the bird works. Put the bird skin side up on a rack set in a rimmed baking sheet. Blast it in a hot oven, I'm talking 450 degrees Fahrenheit, and you'll find that, miraculously, the breast will reach 150 degrees Fahrenheit just as the legs reach 170 degrees Fahrenheit, and the skin reaches delicious. No brining, no salting, no flipping, no problems. As I said, you do lose the prettiness of bringing a whole bird to the table for carving, but you gain the vastly preferable prettiness of perfectly cooked meat instead, and that's a trade-off I'll take any day. Its advantages are numerous. Advantage 1. Flat shape equals even cooking. Butterflying the bird and laying it out flat, with its legs spread out to the sides, means that what were once the most protected parts of the bird, the thighs and drumsticks, are now the most exposed. As a result, they cook faster, precisely what you want when your goal is cooking the dark meat to a higher temperature than the light meat. As an added bonus, the bird doesn't take up nearly as much vertical space in your oven, which means that if you wanted to, you could even cook two birds at once. This is a much better strategy for moist meat than trying to cook one massive bird. Advantage 2. All the skin on top equals juicier meat and crisper skin. A regular chicken or turkey can be approximated as a sphere, with the meat on the inside and the skin on the outside. Because it's resting on a roasting pan or baking sheet, one side of that sphere will always cook more than the other. A spatchcocked chicken, on the other hand, resembles a cuboid, in which the top surface is skin and most of the volume is meat. This leads to three end results. First, all of the skin is exposed to the full heat of the oven the whole time. There is no skin hiding underneath, no underbelly to worry about. Second, there is ample room for the rendering fat to drip out from under the skin and into the pan below. This makes for skin that ends up thinner and crisper. Finally, all of that dripping fat distributes heat energy over the meat as it cooks, both helping it to cook more evenly and creating a temperature buffer, protecting the meat from drying out. Advantage 3. Thinner profile equals faster cooking. In terms of cooking, a sphere is the least efficient shape. That is, for a given mass, it's the shape that'll take the longest for heat to penetrate through to the center. Because of this, a regular roast chicken can take an hour or more to cook, a turkey several hours. But with a spatchcocked bird and its slim profile, you can blast it at 450 degrees Fahrenheit and it'll cook through in about half the time. If I added up all the time I could have saved in Thanksgivings past using this method, I could perhaps, dare I say it, rule the world? Advantage 4. It's easier to carve. Carving a whole chicken can be a tricky affair. Its shape makes it tough to find an angle where you can get good leverage, and I usually resort to flip-flopping the bird around a few times as I carve it. A spatchcocked bird, on the other hand, is simple. The legs nearly fall off all on their own, requiring just a little tug and a single slice with a knife. Rather than having to flip or turn the bird to get at the wings, the laid flat breasts expose them to you, making it easier to get them off without having to lift the chicken from the board. Even the breasts are easier to remove from the carcass, as it lies completely flat and still while you work. Advantage 5. Extra bones equals better gravy. It's always possible to make gravy or jus with nothing but canned chicken stock and drippings. But gravy is so much better when you have some real bones and meat to work with. Normally, that means using the neck and giblets to flavor the broth while the bird roasts. You can still do that, but this way, you can add the entire bird's back to the mix, resulting in a far more flavorful broth. Poultry cooking method 2. If you've got time to spare, divide and conquer. You'll need to know how to break down a bird to use this method, or, to make it far easier, just buy parts individually at the store, as well as being completely willing to kiss any Norman Rockwell dreams of picture-perfect roast birds goodbye. Separating the legs and the breasts from each other makes it a very simple matter to roast the parts together, removing the breasts from the oven once they reach their final temperature and cooking the legs until they reach theirs. After allowing everything to rest, all you need to do is bang the oven up to a raging 500 degrees Fahrenheit, throw everything back inside for a few minutes to crisp up the skin, and dinner is served. To maximize even cooking, I make sure to cook the parts in a very gentle oven, as low a temperature as I have the time and patience for. For the best results, it's always better to leave the breast meat attached to the bones and the skin on when you roast the breasts. This has nothing to do with any kind of mythical exchange of flavor between bones and meat, and everything to do with exposed surfaces. The more surface area of the meat is exposed, the more moisture it'll lose, but the bones and skin help insulate the fragile white meat, preventing it from drying out. The bones are much easier to remove after cooking, if you'd like to do so, and you can always pull off and throw out the skin if you don't want to eat it. Or, better yet, pass it on to someone else in the family who'll be happy to take it off your hands. This method also has a few advantages, namely, that you're not anatomically limited. You want 6 legs and 4 breasts? No problem. And the bird is less cumbersome to move around. Once it's butchered, or even easier, just buy the parts you need pre-butchered, all of the pieces are easy to pick up with tongs or your hands. If you want to really go the extra mile, this method also allows you to cook the breasts and legs by 2 completely different methods, giving you more options at the dinner table. Poultry cooking method 3. For the traditional look, the hot steel. Say you don't want to break down your bird for whatever reason. You prefer the whole bird presentation, or the thought of poultry shears makes you squeamish. I get it. Sometimes you just need a different method. Well, here's a way in which you can start with a whole bird and end up with something that is evenly cooked with reasonably crisp skin without the need to manhandle it before it enters the oven. It does require 1 piece of specialized equipment, a pizza steel or stone. Place it on the lower rack of the oven and allow it to preheat for 30 minutes with your oven at full blast. Place the bird on a rack set on a rimmed baking sheet with the breasts facing up, then place the pan on top of the hot steel or stone. Immediately turn the oven down to 400 degrees Fahrenheit. The retained heat in the steel or stone will give the legs a head start, and you'll find that your whole chicken will come to the right temperatures at pretty much the same time. Pretty easy, right? It won't crisp up quite as well as a spatchcocked bird, nor will it cook as fast. But if you want your bird coming to the table looking like the cover of the Saturday Evening Post, it's your best bet. Should I use the convection setting if my oven has one? A convection oven is nothing more than a regular oven with a fan mechanism inside it. The fan force circulates air throughout the oven, overriding any natural convection currents that form through normal hot and cool zones in a regular oven. What this means is that the entire oven will be heated to a relatively even temperature. The fan also makes food cook faster and crisp better. How so? In a regular oven, cool zones will naturally form around foods and in areas that are protected from radiation heat, such as below the rim of a roasting pan or inside the cavity of a turkey. A convection oven, on the other hand, forces hot air to circulate all around the food, constantly supplying it with plenty of heat energy. It also whisks away surface moisture, causing skin of crusts to dry out faster. This can significantly increase the rate of cooking, as well as make for better, more evenly browned poultry skin or meat crusts. If your oven has one, I recommend using the convection setting, particularly for roasting meats and poultry. The drawback is that most recipes, including the ones in this book, are not specifically designed for convection ovens, so some adjustment is necessary to get them to work as advertised. The general rule of thumb is that if you are using a recipe developed for a conventional oven but cooking in a convection oven, reduce the oven temperature by around 25 degrees. The exact adjustment will vary depending on oven brand and model, so some testing may be required before you learn exactly how your oven works. What makes chicken skin crisp and golden? Chicken skin is composed mainly of 3 elements, water, fat, and protein, mostly collagen. In order for it to become crisp, a few things must happen. First, the collagen must convert to gelatin. Next, the water must evaporate. Finally, the fat must render and run off. What you're left with is skin that's a crispy, golden-brown shell of its former self. To enhance the process, there are several things you can do. First, start with relatively dry chicken. Look for chickens that are labeled air-chilled. Regular chickens are chilled in water, which adds extra moisture to the skin and can prevent good browning. Second, dry the skin well with paper towels. Better yet, if you have the time, let the chicken sit on a rack on a baking sheet uncovered, in the refrigerator for a day. This will jumpstart the drying process, allowing the skin to crisp faster in the oven. But letting it rest for longer than a day is not a good idea. Why is that? Well, collagen breakdown is a time and temperature-dependent process that requires the presence of moisture and a temperature of at least 160 degrees Fahrenheit. For this reason, if you cook your chicken at too low a temperature or let the skin dry too much, by, say, allowing it to rest for several days uncovered in the fridge, you'll end up driving off the moisture required for the collagen to turn into gelatin. The skin becomes papery or leathery instead of crisp. Aiding the rendering of the fat can give you a big boost in good crisping. To do this, you need to create channels for the rendering fat to escape your bird. The most effective means of doing this is to butterfly the bird. You end up with all the skin on top of the meat, exposing it all to the full blast of convective heat from the oven, and leaving plenty of room underneath for the rendering fat to drip down and around the meat. If you are going to keep your bird whole, you should at the very least separate the skin on the breast from the meat to allow room for fat to drip out. To increase airflow and make heating more efficient, I also advise using a heavy-duty rimmed baking sheet with a wire rack set on it instead of a roasting pan with a V-rack. The high sides of a roasting pan can interfere with airflow, leaving you with chicken or turkey that's still flabby and pale in its undercarriage. The only time I use a roasting pan instead of a baking sheet is for extremely large roasts, like a big turkey or a standing rib roast. If it fits on the baking sheet, I'm using the baking sheet. If you want the skin of your roast chicken to stay crisp longer, remove it from the bird right after you take it out of the oven and serve it separately. This will prevent steam from the meat from softening it again. Basting and trussing. Two methods that don't make for juicier meat. I've seen it suggested that barding chicken by draping it with slices of a fatty meat like bacon, or basting it by spooning melted butter or pan juices over the top as it cooks, will help it stay moist. There are two theories behind this. The first is that some of the fat will be absorbed into the breast meat. Poppycock. As our experiments have shown us, that breast meat is shrinking and actively forcing juices out. It certainly ain't absorbing anything. The second theory applies only to barding, and it's that the layer of fat will provide insulation to help the meat cook more gently and prevent it from drying out. This much is true, but here's the problem. As much as I love most things more when they're wrapped in bacon, yes, dear, I'm talking about you, bacon makes mild chicken and turkey taste like, well, bacon. And if I wanted bacon, I'd cook bacon. Then again, if you are the type who likes that flavor in your turkey or chicken, go for it. It also precludes the possibility of crisp skin. In fact, not only does basting the breast with hot pan juices increase the rate at which it cooks, exacerbating the dryness, but the moisture in the juices or melted butter also keeps the skin from crisping properly. A far better solution is to brush your bird occasionally with room temperature oil or rendered duck or chicken fat, if you want to get fancy, as it cooks. This will help you achieve deeper, more even browning, but it won't affect moistness in any way. Trussing, the act of tying up the bird's legs before cooking, is also an oft-recommended but totally pointless exercise. In fact, it has the opposite effect of what you want for a bird, effectively shielding the inner thighs and thereby making the slowest-to-cook part cook even more slowly. Chickens and turkeys should always be left as nature intended them, with their legs wide open to allow for maximum heating via convection. Let it rest. Resting is key to making any roast poultry dinner, particularly a hectic one like Thanksgiving, both easier and tastier. Resting allows time for the meat to relax and the internal juices to redistribute themselves evenly throughout it. Additionally, the slightly cooler temperature will cause the meat's juices to thicken considerably, making them less likely to flow out of the bird when you carve it. I let my birds rest until their internal temperature has dropped down to 143 degrees Fahrenheit or less. For a chicken cooked to 150 degrees Fahrenheit, this will take between 10 and 15 minutes. For a 10 to 12 pound turkey, it can take over 30 minutes. But consider that an added bonus. You've now got an extra half hour to do things like deglaze your pan drippings, heat up your casseroles, have a cocktail, and make whipped cream to cover up the fingerprints you left on the pumpkin pie. What about flavor? To be perfectly frank, 90% of the time I roast a chicken, I rely on salt and pepper alone. If you've got yourself a really great chicken, its flavor should speak for itself. But what if you want to add a little extra something to it? Here's the good news. Once you have the basic roasting techniques down, adding flavor is as simple as a good rub or some herbs applied before cooking. The actual cooking method is exactly the same. Those dozens or hundreds of chicken recipes you can find online for herb rubbed this or lemon that, they're really all the same old roast chicken with a few flavors added to it. What that means is that once you understand what makes chicken good, proper roasting technique, not overcooking the breasts, allowing the skin to render, how you flavor the bird is entirely up to you. To get you started, I put together a little chart that shows you how to apply various flavors to your bird, along with a few specific recipe variations that I enjoy. Of course, you can mix and match all of these flavoring agents as desired. In the chart, I haven't listed any salt, because in the two basic recipes that follow, the chicken is seasoned separately with salt. But you can just as easily add the salt directly to any herb rub or spice mixture to season and flavor the bird in one step. You can find this flavoring chart on the bonus PDF. Should I marinate my chicken? When I was in college, I remember receiving a mass email from a housemate that said, "I'm leaving for the weekend, but there's a chicken in the fridge that's been marinating in Italian dressing for 3 days. Somebody should cook it. It'll be super tender and juicy." I snapped up the chicken, planning to use it as a surefire way to finally seduce the girl who lived down the hall. She'd be so impressed by its moistness and flavor that she'd instantly fall in love. We'd get married and serve chicken at the reception, of course, have 14 kids, and live happily ever after. That I'm now happily married to an entirely different girl tells you something about how that worked out. Turns out that you can over-marinate chicken, particularly if using an acidic marinade, such as Italian dressing. The acid in the marinade will cause the proteins to denature, the same way that cooking them does. Given enough time, the denatured proteins will squeeze out moisture, and the chicken will take on a dry, chalky texture. Just as with steak, there's no need to marinate poultry for any more than half a day or so. Actually, far more effective use of a marinade for chicken and other poultry is to apply some of it to the roasting bird 10 minutes or so before you take it out of the oven and save most of it to apply after resting and carving, when it can really coat every surface and deliver flavor with each bite. Roasting turkey. Turkey gets a bum rap, and I blame it all on Thanksgiving. Roast turkey is one of the few foods that we often only prepare once a year, and, as a result, most people never really get too good at cooking it. Year after year, we gather around the holiday table, thinking about that turkey like we think about our family members, one of those things we just have to put up with before the wine and the pie kick in. It's a crying shame, because turkey is one of my favorite birds to eat, and it's a great, inexpensive option that should be on the roster year-round. Turkey Association of America, you can mail that check to my home address. It's got more flavor than chicken, and everyone knows that nothing beats leftover turkey for making soups, sandwiches, and all manner of treats for the rest of the week. In theory, roasting a turkey is not all that different from roasting a chicken. The same basic problems and solutions apply. It's just a matter of adjusting scale and timing. If you follow food media, you may notice that every single year, every magazine, blog, and television show comes out with a brand new recipe for roast turkey, claiming it as the be-all, end-all, world's best, you'll never need another recipe. Until the next year rolls around. Now, one could give them all the benefit of the doubt and assume that every year they're telling the truth. If so, what a happy world we live in. For, year after year, the quality of our roast turkeys is progressing on a never-ending, sure and steady upward path toward perfection. Or you could go for the real answer. We food writers are all liars. Okay, so it's not so bad as all that. The truth is, there's no one best way to cook a turkey. And anybody who tells you different is selling something, most likely a magazine or book. Wink, wink. There is a near endless list of goals and restrictions based on the tastes, skills, and time constraints of different home cooks, and thus a near endless supply of recipes for turkey. Some people want that perfect golden brown centerpiece in the middle of the table. Some want their share of stuffing moist with drippings. Others care only for the meat, pushing even the crispest, crackliest, saltiest bits of skin off to the side of their plates. We shall speak no more of these heathens. The perfectionist. Thanksgiving turkey two ways. We've already talked about the problems of cooking poultry, the main one being that legs and breasts need to cook at different temperatures. If you're not too worried about absolute perfection, the recipe from earlier will do you just fine. The hot steel or stone will help the thighs cook fast enough to keep abreast of the, breast. If true perfection is what you're after, though, you're better off breaking the turkey down into parts to be cooked individually. That way, the breast and legs can be cooked to precisely the right temperature. The divide-and-conquer method mostly works for turkeys, save for one small problem. While it's far easier to cook the breast alone than a whole bird, the narrower, tapered end of the breast can still overcook and dry out, meaning that at least one family member is going to get stuck with subpar turkey. Sorry, Granddad. Lowering the oven temperature helps. Roasting it at 250 degrees Fahrenheit, rather than cooking it at a normal 300 degrees to 350 degree Fahrenheit range, promotes more even cooking between the edges and center and between the thick and thin parts, but it's not quite enough. What I needed was a way to even out the shape of my turkey breast, and while I'm confident there are bioengineers hard at work developing turkeys with perfectly cylindrical breasts, for the time being, I had to resort to some kitchen surgery. So, how do you take an unevenly shaped turkey breast and turn it into a perfect cylinder? Simple. Remove the breasts from the bones and put them together head to heels, then wrap the whole thing up with their breast skin and tie it up to roast slowly. Then, after the breast is cooked, brown it on the stovetop and crisp up the skin. This method offers a few distinct advantages. Even cooking. Because of its symmetrical shape, the turkey breast cooks through along its entire length at the same rate. Nobody gets stuck with a dry piece. Better seasoning. By removing the breasts from the carcass, you expose more surface area, and you can then season the breasts on both sides before assembling the turkey roll. Easier carving. With no bones and an even shape, carving a turkey breast is as simple as slicing a tenderloin. Better gravy. With the bones from the breast at your disposal, it's easy to make a delicious, very turkey-y gravy. It all sounds great, right? And it is. But after all the work I've done on improving those darn breasts, the legs are beginning to feel a little left out. Should they be content with plain old roasting? Well, sure, if you feel like you can just add them to the baking sheet while the breast roll cooks and make sure they reach at least 160 degrees to 170 degrees Fahrenheit before taking them out and following the same searing procedure. If you want to go the extra mile, though, my favorite way to serve Thanksgiving turkey legs is to braise them until falling apart tender. Gravy tips. The turkey recipes make their own gravy, but at my table, there's never enough gravy to go around. This gravy is just about the easiest way to get more without having to resort to that awful store-bought stuff. Here are a few tips. You don't need to make your own stock. Sure, in an ideal world, when you have the time and inclination, making your own stock by browning the chopped carcass and neck of your bird and simmering it with lots of vegetables is the best way to make gravy. But a good quality, low-sodium, store-bought chicken stock makes a flavorful base for a homemade gravy that's far better than the jarred stuff. Even if you are planning on using your turkey neck and scraps, highly recommended, use stock to simmer them instead of water for an instant flavor boost. Make your gravy in advance. The gravy can be made at least a few days before Thanksgiving. Get your bird ahead of time, and you'll have the neck and giblets to work with. Make your gravy on Monday or Tuesday, then refrigerate it, and don't even think about it until Turkey Day. It'll reheat well in a small saucepan or in the microwave. Stir it every 30 seconds while microwaving to make sure it doesn't explode. Reach for the umami bombs. When used judiciously, Marmite and soy sauce can seriously increase flavor, adding depth and savoriness to your gravy. A quarter teaspoon of Marmite and a teaspoon of soy sauce for every quart of gravy is about the right amount. Add aromatics. If going the store-bought broth route, try first simmering it down with a couple of bay leaves, peppercorns, and some fresh herbs, like thyme or parsley stems. You'll be amazed at the depth of flavor it picks up with just a quick 30-minute simmer. Deglaze your roasting pan. Remember that your turkey or chicken will give off plenty of flavorful liquids and solids while it's roasting. Look at the bottom of the pan when the bird is done. See the browned bits in there? That's called fond, and it is an instant gravy booster. While your bird is resting, place the roasting pan over a burner and pour in some stock. Scrape up the browned bits with a wooden spoon, then strain and use this enhanced stock as the base for your gravy. If you make your gravy in advance, you can give it a last-minute boost by deglazing the pan with a little stock and whisking it into the gravy just before serving. Thicken the right way. To thicken 4 cups gravy, melt 4 tablespoons unsalted butter in a medium skillet over medium heat. Add 1/4 cup all-purpose flour and cook, stirring constantly with a wooden spoon until you have a nice golden blonde color, which will add some nuttiness. Slowly add your stock, whisking constantly. The harder you whisk and the more slowly you add the stock, the smoother your gravy will be. Once you've added all the liquid, bring it up to a boil, then reduce it to a simmer and let it cook down, stirring occasionally until it gets to the right consistency. Season it at the end with salt and pepper. Seasoning too early can lead to the salt concentrating and becoming too strong. Classic sage and sausage stuffing. I'm a stuffing fiend. It's easily my favorite part of the holiday meal, and as far as I'm concerned, a side dish worth making any time of the year. For those of you oddballs out there who still refer to the stuff as dressing, well, I'm not going to come down on either side of the whole nomenclature debate, except to say that 3 reputable sources give 3 different answers. The Oxford English Dictionary says that stuffing is stuffed in a bird or joint, roast, while dressing is a more general term for seasoning that goes with food or sauce. The Joy of Cooking contends that they are one and the same, except one is in the bird and one is out. The Food Lover's Companion says the 2 terms can be used interchangeably. With that out of the way, I expect to hear no more on that semantics discussion this holiday season. So, moving on, stuffing. While it can be made with any number of bases, the most popular type, and my favorite, is made with bread, broth, eggs, and butter. Essentially, it's best to think of stuffing as a savory bread pudding when constructing a recipe. The key to great bread pudding is to use the bread as a sponge to soak up as much flavorful liquid as possible. At the same time, you don't want it to be spongy. The cooked stuffing should have a moist, tender, custard-like texture. It should be firm enough to cut with a knife, but soft enough to eat with a spoon, with a bit of space left over to soak up some gravy. Much of this has to do with how you pick and handle your bread. But before you get there, you've got to decide what kind of bread you are going to use. Whole grain breads may have more flavor on their own, but they are rougher in texture than white flour breads. Since in a stuffing, the bread is more a vehicle for flavor than a flavor on its own, I prefer to use a white bread as it achieves a more custard-like texture. It's tempting to use a high-quality, crusty, chewy, large-hold, fancy-pants artisanal bread, but the finer hole structure of regular supermarket-style Italian or French bread, or just high-quality white sandwich bread, makes for better flavor absorption and retention, and that's what stuffing is all about. After you've cubed your bread, the next stage is to dry it out. It may surprise you, but drying and staling are not the same thing. Though many recipes call for stale bread, what they're actually looking for is dry bread. Staling takes time. Luckily for us, drying is fast. I dry my bread by toasting it in a low 275-degree Fahrenheit oven for about 45 minutes, tossing it a couple of times halfway through. By drying the bread like this, you make enough room in the cubes from two regular-sized loaves, about 2.5 pounds, to absorb a full 4 cups of chicken or turkey broth. It's so much broth that the stuffing will almost taste as if you baked it in the bird if you do it in a separate pan. I recommend starting it with foil on top to trap in some moisture before removing the foil and crisping up the top. The flavorings I go with are classic: butter, and plenty of it, sage sausage — you can get away with just sage for a non-meaty version — onions, celery, and garlic. My sister likes to add dried cranberries, and my mother likes to add chestnuts. They are, of course, both wrong. Drying versus staling. Drying and staling are not the same thing. Here's the difference. Drying involves the evaporation of moisture from within a piece of bread. The structure of the bread remains more or less the same, though it becomes less pliable because of the moisture loss. Dry, not stale, bread will be crisp like a cracker and crumble into a fine powder. Bread that has dried out is very hard to refresh. Staling is the process by which moisture migrates out of swollen starch granules and into the spaces in the bread. The moisture-deprived starch molecules then recrystallize, forming tough structures within the bread. Stale, not dry, bread will taste leathery and chewy, not crackery or dry. Bread that has staled can be refreshed by heating it, causing the starch granules to reabsorb moisture. It's quite possible for bread to stale without drying. Just think about what happens to a loaf of preservative-free bread when you place it in the refrigerator overnight. Staling actually occurs much faster at cooler temperatures, which is why your bread will become leathery and chewy by the next morning, no matter how tightly it was wrapped. In order to prevent both staling and drying, it's best to store bread tightly wrapped on the countertop or in a bread box if you're going to eat it within a day or two. For long-term storage, wrap your loaves in foil and pop them into the freezer. This will freeze the internal water molecules, preventing them from migrating out of the bread and thus stopping it from staling. Reheat frozen bread in a 300-degree Fahrenheit oven, wrapped in its foil, until warmed through. Really easy cranberry sauce. I understand the appeal of canned, jellied cranberry sauce. It plops out of the can, has those pretty ridges, and can be sliced up and placed right in the center of a plateful of curly parsley. It's got a kind of Betty Crocker appeal to it. But whole berry sauce in a can or jar? Why, when homemade is so much better and blindingly simple to do? Here's why to make it yourself. First off, cranberries are extremely high in pectin. This is the cellular glue that holds plants together and is the primary gelling agent in jellies. Unlike most other berries, which require you to add powdered or liquid pectin to get the requisite gel level, cranberries already contain the perfect amount. That means that all you've got to do is cook them down with some sugar and just a touch of water to get them started, and they basically do all the work themselves, setting into a jelly all on their own. Cranberries and cranberry sauce also have an extremely long shelf life, in part due to their high acidity, in addition to naturally high levels of antimicrobial phenolic compounds. Fresh cranberries can keep for weeks, if not months, in the refrigerator. I make my Thanksgiving cranberry sauce at least a week ahead of time. Then it sits in the fridge, no problem, and saves me from having to think about it on Turkey Day. Which is not to say you should restrict yourself to serving cranberry sauce only on Thanksgiving. It makes an awesome accompaniment for grilled or roasted pork and chicken, sausages, or meatballs. Finally, making cranberry sauce yourself lets you adjust the flavorings any way you like them. I'm a purist at heart, so my sauce most often contains nothing but cranberries and sugar, with perhaps the occasional hint of cinnamon. Cranberries contain spicy phenolic compounds similar to those in cinnamon, so the flavors go quite well together. But here are a few more ideas. Orange. Replace the water in the recipe with orange juice. Add a couple of teaspoons of grated orange zest along with the cranberries. Ginger. Add a teaspoon of grated fresh ginger along with the cranberries, then finish the sauce by stirring in a tablespoon of finely diced crystallized ginger. Spices. Cinnamon, as I mentioned, works well, as does grated nutmeg or ground allspice or cloves. Start with a pinch and work your way up until it tastes the way you like it. A bit of vanilla or spiced rum added toward the end of cooking will also spice things up a bit. Dried fruits. A handful of raisins or currants can add texture and flavor. Add them right at the beginning to allow them to soften. Nuts. Toasted almonds, pecans, pistachios, or walnuts, roughly chopped and mixed into the sauce at the end, make a classic pairing. The Food Lab's Complete Guide to Beef Roasts. You've already heard the guide on steaks, and most of that information applies here as well. Grading, coloring, aging, and labeling are all identical, whether you are talking about individual steaks and chops or entire roasts. Here's the additional information you need to know for the latter. Bones. Here's one for you. Bone in or bone out? I've always wondered about this one myself, so I ran a series of tests. Many chefs say that cooking meat on the bone is always a better idea because the bone contributes lots of flavor. I'm skeptical. First of all, most of the flavor in a bone is deep inside in the marrow. If you ever make a stock out of just bones, you'll find that it's almost tasteless unless the bones are cracked first. And as far as flavor penetration goes, there's very little movement of molecules across a piece of meat. Even marinating overnight will only get you a couple millimeters of penetration. More on that in a moment. What chance does any flavor from the bone have of getting into the meat during the short roasting or pan-searing time? To test this, I cooked four identical prime rib roasts. The first was cooked with a bone on. For the second, I removed the bone, but then tied it back against the meat for cooking. For the third, I removed the bone and tied it back against the meat, but with an intervening piece of impermeable heavy-duty aluminum foil. The fourth was cooked without the bone. Tasted side by side, the first three were indistinguishable from one another. The fourth, on the other hand, was a little tougher in the region next to where the bone used to be. What does this indicate? Well, first off, it means the flavor exchange theory is bunk. The completely intact piece of meat tasted exactly the same as the one with the intervening aluminum foil. But it also means that the bone serves at least one important function. It insulates the meat, slowing its cooking and providing less surface area to lose moisture. Bottom line, the best way to cook your beef roast is to detach the bone and then tie it back on. You get the same cooking quality of a completely intact roast, with the advantage that once it's cooked, carving it is as simple as cutting the string, removing the bone, and slicing. For pan-seared steaks, I opt for bone-in just because I like gnawing on the bones for dessert. What exactly is a prime rib roast? To locate the prime rib, start by cutting your favorite steer neatly down the center from head to tail. set aside one half for another use. Place your hand on the back of the other half and feel your way back along its vertebrae until you start feeling ribs. Count backwards to the sixth rib and cut crosswise through the meat in front of it. Then continue counting back until you get to rib 12 and cut behind it, again crosswise. Reserve the head and tail section for another use, saving the ribs you just cut out. Now saw the ribs off at about 13 to 16 inches down their length and set aside the belly section. Take off the hide, and what you're left with is the prime rib. It consists of 7 full ribs with a large eye of meat running along their backside. This meat is part of the loin muscle of the cow, the same muscle that New York strip, ribeye, and Delmonico steaks are cut from. It's also often referred to as a standing rib roast because, well, it comes from the ribs and it stands up as it roasts. Does prime rib have anything to do with prime grade beef? Glad you asked. The answer is no. The term prime rib has existed longer than the USDA's beef grading system, which classifies beef according to its potential tenderness and juiciness into various grades. The roast is called prime rib because it's what many butchers and consumers traditionally considered the best part of the cow. After the USDA began using its labeling system with the label prime denoting the highest quality, things became a little confusing. It's possible to buy a prime rib that is also prime grade, but it doesn't necessarily have to be so. My local Whole Foods sells choice grade prime rib, for example, while the discount supermarket around the corner also carries select grade prime rib. What's a good size roast to buy? Generally, you want to aim for about a pound of bone-in prime rib per person, more if you have a hungry clan. A full 7-rib prime rib is a massive hunk of meat, between 20 to 30 pounds. That's too big to fit into my oven, which is why I, like most people, buy my prime rib in 3 or 4-rib sections. These sections have different names, depending on where they are cut from. The chuck end, ribs 6 through 9 from closer to the cow's shoulder, aka the chuck, referred to variously as the chuck end, blade end, or second cut. It's got more separate musculature and more large hunks of fat than the loin end. Personally, I prefer this end because I like to eat the fat in a well-roasted piece of beef. The loin end, ribs 10 through 12, taken from farther back and also known as the small end or first cut. It's got a larger central eye of meat and less fat. Depending on what part of the country you live in, your butcher may refer to these cuts as different things. But any butcher should know which ribs are which, so ask for a roast with ribs 6 through 9 or 10 through 12, and you should be fine. Cooking time. I've got my beef, so now can I just follow a timing chart to know when it's cooked? No, no, no. Do yourself a favor and throw out every roasting timing chart you have. The only reliable way, I repeat, the only reliable way to tell when your beef is done is to use an accurate thermometer, like the Thermapen from ThermoWorks. No matter what cooking method or oven temperature you use, as long as the center of your meat never goes above the right temperature, you'll be guaranteed the right results. Serving a picky crowd. My dainty aunt likes her meat rare, but my tempestuous brother prefers his well done. What's an understanding and generous host to do? First off, you should wonder how your brother was created out of the same genetic material as you. After that, you've got a couple options. Because most roasts are not an even shape, you'll probably end up with a few pieces that are more cooked than others, even when you cook with very gentle heat. These slices generally come from near the ends of the roast, where energy is penetrating the meat through more surfaces. If those pieces are still not cooked enough for your bro, the best thing to do is take his slices, stick them on a rimmed baking sheet, and throw them back into the oven until they are the desired shade of dry. Leftovers. Gramps decided not to show up for dinner. What's the best way to store his leftovers? An all-too-common dilemma. For short-term storage, your best bet is to just tightly wrap the meat in plastic and keep it in the fridge. It'll last for around 3 days. Bear in mind that rare or medium-rare meat may turn brownish, remember myoglobin, in the fridge, but this isn't necessarily a sign of spoilage. For that, just follow your nose. For longer-term storage of larger pieces of either cooked or uncooked meat, you'll want to freeze them. If you've got a vacuum sealer, use it. Air is the enemy of frozen food, causing it to dry out in an irrevocable process known as freezer burn. If you don't have a vacuum sealer, wrap the meat tightly, first in foil, plastic wrap is not airtight, and then a few layers of plastic wrap, and place it in the freezer. The plastic wrap helps keep the foil tightly against the surface of the meat, while the foil prevents air from coming in contact with it. Let your meat defrost in the refrigerator. This can take as long as a couple days for larger cuts of meat. Did I hear that right? Plastic wrap is not airproof? That's correct. Air can still travel through plastic wrap, though quite slowly. What about reheating? If you are wise, you will have been slicing the meat to order, leaving you with a large chunk of leftover roast rather than many thin slices. The best way to reheat a large chunk of meat, thicker than 1.5 inches, is to treat it like you would a steak, which, after all, it is. Warm it in a low oven until it is about 10 degrees below the desired serving temperature, then sear it in a hot skillet to crisp and brown the exterior. For thinner cuts, you can simply sear them in a skillet straight from the fridge, just like a steak. Alternatively, the microwave is surprisingly effective. Just remember this cardinal rule: no matter how you reheat it, do not let it rise above the initial temperature you cooked it to, or it will be overcooked. If you've already sliced the whole roast extremely thin, your best option is sandwiches and salads. Still delicious. What about those chefs who cook their prime ribs sous vide or sear them with various pieces of industrial machinery? Leave the fancy pants methods to the fancy pants. In my experience, cooking large roasts, whether prime rib or turkey, in a sous vide water bath certainly guarantees perfectly, evenly cooked results, but the deep, roasted flavor notes you get from meat roasted in the open air are completely absent. It's also a pain in the butt to vacuum seal an entire prime rib. I much prefer mine done in a low-temperature oven. As for torching, it looks really cool, but the results are not worth the trouble. Torching before roasting gives you a surface that's nearly burnt in spots and barely browned in others, while torching after roasting doesn't do nearly as good a job as a hot oven or roasting pan set over a couple burners. How to roast beef, aka perfect prime rib. A 4-pound roast of well-marbled prime beef rib is not cheap, and while my friends provide me with as many mental and philosophical riches as a man could ask for, and my wife supplies an adequate amount of emotional wealth, dollars and cents are not something I, being a humble food writer, part with lightly. As such, when I buy a good quality piece of beef, and honestly, does beef get any better than prime rib? I have a strong impetus not to mess it up, as do, I imagine, most of you. In writing this section, I decided to get through a lifetime's worth of messings up so that I, and I hope you too, will never again serve anything but a perfectly cooked roast. First, a definition of perfection. Commandment 1. The perfect prime rib must have a deep brown, crisp, crackly, salty exterior crust. Commandment 2. The gradient at the interface between the brown crust and the perfectly medium-rare interior of the perfect prime rib must be absolutely minimized, as in, I don't want a layer of overcooked meat around the edges. Commandment 3. The perfect prime rib must retain as many juices as possible. Subcommandment 1. The perfect prime rib must be cooked without the use of heavy or specialized equipment, including propane or oxyacetylene torches, sous vide machines, or CVAP ovens. Highs and lows. Before I tried to start figuring out how to achieve all these goals simultaneously, it was helpful to note that when cooking beef to medium rare, there are really only two temperatures that matter. 125 degrees Fahrenheit is the temperature at which beef is medium rare, that is, hot but still pink, cooked but still moist, and able to retain its juices. Any higher than that, and the muscle fibers start to rapidly shrink, forcing flavorful juices out of the meat and into the bottom of the roasting pan. 310 degrees Fahrenheit is the temperature at which the Maillard reaction, that wonderfully complicated process by which amino acids and reducing sugars recombine to form enticing roasty aromas, really begins to take off. At this range, meat will quickly brown and crisp. Ah, a dilemma revealed itself. In order to maximize browning, I had to cook the meat in a sufficiently hot oven. I tried 400 degrees Fahrenheit. But at the same time, I didn't want the interior to reach above 125 degrees Fahrenheit. Since a big beef roast cooks from the outside in, by the time the center had reached 125 degrees Fahrenheit, that is, 120 degrees Fahrenheit in the oven, followed by a 5-degree rise in temperature after resting, there was a perfectly browned exterior, but the outermost layers had risen closer to around 165 degrees Fahrenheit to 180 degrees Fahrenheit, rendering them overcooked, gray, and dry, their juices having been squeezed out. Score? Commandment 1. Perfect crust? Check. Commandment 2. No gray zone? Negative. Commandment 3. Full-on juiciness? Negative. Okay, so what if I went to the opposite extreme, cooking the roast at a much lower temperature? I cooked another roast in a 200 degree Fahrenheit oven until the center reached 125 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, just as with boiled eggs, the temperature at which you cook is directly related to the difference in temperatures between the center and the outside layers. In other words, by cooking it at a lower temperature, you minimize the proportion of beef that goes above the ideal final temperature. I was able to eliminate the gray band of overcooked meat almost completely. Of course, any browning was also right out the window, leaving me with a roast with pale, anemic exterior. Score, Commandment 1. Perfect crust? Negative. Commandment 2. No gray zone? Check. Commandment 3. Full-on juiciness? Unknown. The myth of